Hello and welcome to Literary Italy. Follow us on Facebook at Literary Italy, on Instagram at Literary Italy Podcast, and on Twitter at Literary Italy. Our website address is www.literaryitaly.com. Our email address is mail@literaryitaly.com. We love hearing from listeners.
We love it.
If you enjoy our podcast, please subscribe or follow us using your podcast app. That really helps us. Also, please consider giving us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts, at Spotify, at Google, at Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this podcast. Please spread the word. Hi, Anne.
Hello, Jim.
How are you?
I am doing fine.
Good.
Happy day. Today, we are going to be talking about E.M. Forster's novel, A Room with a View.
Yeah, I feel like this is going to be, hopefully for our listeners, kind of like comfort food. I feel like this is one of those things
Oh, this is an easy one.
Well, no, but I think it's one of those things that gets people interested in Italy and Tuscany broadly. At least for me, I remember when I was in my 20s going to see the movie, the 80s movie, and thinking, oh, that sounds, I have to make it there.
You yes, know? Yes. So it was a 1985 film. It won some awards. I can't remember which, but it's got tons of stars in it. A young Helena Bonham Carter stars as Lucy Honeychurch, the main character. Who are some of the other? There's Maggie Smith,
Julian Sands. He's George. Denham Elliott.
Denham Elliott
as Mr. Emerson. He never gets a name. He's just Mr. Emerson, the older Mr. Emerson.
Yeah, and he's not George Senior. George is not named after his father. But anyway, so E.M. Forster is a British writer. The novel was written in 1908, and he was born 1879. So it really was one of his earlier works. He actually started, I believe, he started it around 1901. It was
before he went there.
Yes, it was probably one of his, at least the start of it, was one of his earliest works. E.M. Forster, also known for a number of other novels, including Where Angels Fear to Tread. So this book, A Room with a View, and Where Angels Fear to Tread are kind of like, they're coupled in this Every Man's Library edition as the Italian novels. But in addition to that, he's well known for the novel Howard's End, which also was a great movie.
Right.
That's
Passage to India.
Right. Which is 1924.
Also a very... And
nominated.
Then he stops writing novels.
Well, he's not, it doesn't stop writing.
He stops writing novels, though. Passage to India is his last novel, and he's probably a little over 40 at that point. And he lives until 1970.
Yeah. So he's a fascinating writer. I love Forster. I love the way he writes. I'm not sure whether I've read this 2 or 3 times, but every time I read it, it's fresh and new to me. And I think one of the things I love the most about Forster is that narrator, that narrative voice that he has, which I assume is Forster, but doesn't necessarily, I mean, the narrator can be a character as much as anyone
but
else.
But it's a very arch, very He's funny. Ironic.
He's
yes.
very, very funny. So, yes. I mean, here's a book that's over 100 years old, and I feel, as I just said, it's very fresh and fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really fun read, a very pleasant read.
Yeah. So he did take this, I mean, he traveled quite a bit. He did take that trip to Italy and Greece in 1904, which certainly, I'm sure that influenced his writing for this, the Room with a View, and then also that the next novel, which I think is 2 years later, Where Angels Fear to Tread. Mm. He ran with a circle of friends, intellectual friends of the early 20th century, and was active in the Bloomsbury Group in the 2010s mm-hmm. and the 2020s.
The 1910s, 1920s.
I mean, I'm sorry. Yeah, we're in the 2020s. 100 years ago.
He was way ahead of his time.
Yeah. Knew, obviously, like, you know, Virginia Woolf, and who supposedly, I didn't realize this, along with her sister, may be the models for the sisters in Howard's End. These kind of progressive, forward-thinking characters. So, Room with a View. So, I would assume that it is, the story is fairly well known, perhaps better known because of the film
mm-hmm.
to our listeners. I don't know. Maybe I'm totally wrong. Maybe people don't watch a whole lot of Merchant Ivory. But the 1985 movie got a lot of buzz at the time. And I remember seeing it too. And yes, I also saw this movie before I ever set foot in Italy. Did it make me want to go there?
Well, it looks beautiful. I mean, like most Merchant Ivory productions.
Sure. The cinematography is always gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me, actually, when I think about it, because when I first went to Italy, the first time I went to Italy, I lived in Rome for several months, and I didn't get to Florence for almost, you know, probably about 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And my initial reaction to Florence was not overwhelmingly positive. You know, I found it to be very gray, you know, just the buildings, it's just seemed more serious and dour than Rome.
Than Rome, yeah.
And maybe some of that's probably the climate. And it may have just been that I was there for 3 or 4 days that were cloudy. But then having returned to the city a number of times and then having lived there 2.5 years on separate occasions, both, you know, on my own as a university student and then with you, Jim. And then again, you know, when we had a child, we kind of had an interesting, it gave a different perspective of seeing the city as a young woman, you know, let's say like Lucy Honeychurch, and then coming back to it later on as a matron. So do you want to give a little brief synopsis of the novel? Or
Yeah, I'll fumble my way through it because I always get these things wrong. I get the details wrong, so you can correct me. And we can talk.
And this is the first time you read it, right?
First time I read it, yeah.
Is this the first Forrester you've ever read?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay.
This is like one of those reaction videos you see on YouTube where someone's like listening to Stevie Wonder for the first time going, wow, oh.
Yeah, I thought like unboxing.
That's like a thing. Like, no, that's a thing where people, like, it's usually millennials who are like listening to, like, they've never heard a Beatles song and they listen to it for the first time. And then you watch it as it blows their
I was
mind.
Thinking of those unboxing videos, and you could have something that would be incredibly, it would be like 6 hours of just watching someone read a novel for the first
nice.
Time.
Yeah.
And their reaction.
Good.
But the
it's a
payoff.
Reaction. Yeah.
Like,
the
you
payoff
know,
is pretty good.
You'd have to have the patience to watch 7 hours of someone.
Yeah. A Room with a View, Lucy Honeychurch and her chaperone, Charlotte Bartlett, which is very hard to say fast, are in Charlotte Bartlett. Charlotte Bartlett, Charlotte Bartlett, Charlotte Bartlett. They're on part of the grand tour there in Florence, and they are put out at the beginning of the novel because the room that they were promised is not the room. The room the signora promised them is not the room at Casa Bertolini is not the room that they've gotten, and they don't have a view in that. It looks out at, I guess, probably another building rather than to the Arno or to the fields.
Right.
And, another guest, Mr. Emerson, very boldly says, well, men don't
right.
like
Which
offers.
Shows that he's been listening in on
he's been listening, listening in on the conversation and offers his room. And they are.
And that of his handsome
shocked,
young son.
They are shocked at his impudence because he insists. He's very forceful and he's very unconventional and insists that they take the room. And the chaperone finds this to be somewhat beyond the pale. She just thinks this man is.
Well, she's also trying to get a sense of, are these Emersons the right sort of people?
Right.
I mean, she's.
And also she's very conscious of being a chaperone
yes.
to a young woman, and anything that would put this young woman in the debt of this handsome young man gets her, sets off her radar.
Well, because, so, and she says it. I mean, her trip is fully paid by Lucy's parents.
By Mrs. Honeychurch.
By Lucy's mother. Or presumably her father has, yes, her father has passed away. By Lucy's family. So she has, you got one job, Charlotte.
Right.
To keep this girl, get this girl back to England a virgin. I mean, I think that's.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's pretty, I mean, well, that's, but, you know, more than that. She really is entrusted with a lot. And she takes it very seriously, but at the same time, I think sees. Well, we'll come to that more at the
end. Isn't that kind of a microcosm, though? Because one of the things, even at this point, before we get into the romance of it, the thing that I love the beginning of the novel so much because it's, there is a desire by all of the British travelers to experience real Italy, and yet at the same time, to wrap themselves in this bubble of Britishness that just goes with them wherever they go. And it's that, and I very strongly identify with that. I totally get that because I know on this podcast, Dan, you and I talk about the importance of really trying, you learn the language and you try to get
yourself,
there.
Yeah.
But at the same time, people also like to be comfortable, right? And I certainly for anyone listening to the podcast, I would much rather someone decides to go to Italy and do a Pirelli tour or do, you know, do whatever it takes to get out there. If it means that, you know, I can't live without peanut butter and ketchup that you bring peanut, not together, obviously, but you bring those things that make you comfortable. It's yeah. much better to see Italy in a bubble than not to see Italy at all. And that's kind of what they do, right?
I was just thinking of McDonald's. There's something, so Pensione Bertolini, where they're staying, is a pensione run by an Italian family.
But what's the story of the signora, though, is Brit?
She speaks English and, you know.
With a Cockney accent.
Yes, because that's how she's learned it. But right. that they're all together, you know, they're all English there. I was thinking of McDonald's. So
right.
there's something about, I was thinking when we, a couple trips we've taken with the kids, we've always kept McDonald's like in our back pocket as the emergency, or maybe it's this emergency cord, you know, or in case of, you know, cranky children break glass, that it is something familiar. You know, more or less what it's going to taste like. Like it doesn't vary because they use the same recipe and they're all coming from the same, whatever, McDonald's factory. And sometimes it is comforting to get something that you know what it's going to be like.
Right.
You go to one pizzeria, you might, I mean, most of the pizza in Italy is good, but it's going to be different from one pizzeria to the next.
And they are intent on seeing the sights and seeing, but yes. There's very much that attention to having the Baedeker guide that's going to tell you exactly the relevance of every painting. They're going to tell you what you see before you see it.
Yes.
And you're going
and
to see it the way they tell you
too.
To see it.
There is this sense of travel as checking off boxes.
Yeah.
And yes, and they're following Baedeker. We had this discussion whether it's Baedeker or Baedeker.
I say Baedeker.
You say Baedeker. 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 Yeah, Baedeker. And that was a, you know, a guidebook. And so that brings us into this other topic that we're going to talk about today, which is the Grand Tour, which we talked about a little bit with Dacia Marini in Bagheria, her book Bagheria, because this relatively small town, Bagheria, outside of Palermo, was also a stop on the Grand Tour if people chose to continue down south to Sicily like Goethe did. Lucy Honeychurch does not. She gets to Rome, and they turn around and go back. So I'm sorry because I interrupted you, but you were up to this. So there they are at the Pensione Bertolini. They change rooms with the young George Emerson and his father, Mr. Emerson.
Yes.
And they begin to know the Emersons. And it's still, Charlotte's trying to feel them out. Are they the right sort of people, the Emersons?
Well, they're not the right sort of people because Mr. Emerson's a socialist and he's way
opinionated.
Opinionated. He'll tell you exactly what he means. Let me tell you exactly what I mean. That kind of a guy.
Yeah. But so Lucy meets up with them again in the Church of Santa Croce, which I think we've probably talked about when talking about Dante. It's where you can find the empty tomb of Dante, but not Dante's body itself. And And Santa Croce is fascinating as being this, you know, the who's who of Italian culture, literature, and history. They're all buried there. And she's following this, you know, the local, he's the Anglican priest in Florence. So he's a British priest in Florence who's giving this tour. And of course, Mr. Emerson has to interject and interrupt and contradict the mm-hmm. things. And I think Lucy finds that despite herself, she's really kind of charmed by Mr. Emerson, mm-hmm. by his yes. authenticity. And later, actually another day, she goes out on her own. I think Charlotte's not feeling well or something like that. So Lucy goes off on her own to walk around.
Doesn't she actually go with, I thought she goes with the novelist, with Miss Lavish.
It's a different time. She goes with Miss, they also meet a woman, middle-aged woman, novelist, kind of like a romance writer, Miss Lavish. There are a whole bunch of really, I find fun them very characters. Fun, minor characters, but they're actually important to the story.
Right.
They're more than just, window dressing.
Yeah, I think we can say basically a furtive romance blooms between.
Well, what happens, and this is, I do think this is kind of probably the most dramatic scene of the entire novel, is Lucy's in the Piazza Signoria. Am I right about this? Yes, the Piazza. Mm-hmm. It's not the Piazza by the Duomo. She's in the Piazza Signoria. And she witnesses a murder between two Italian men, apparently a fight over a debt or something like that. And one man stabs the other and falls on Lucy. I mean, the dying man falls on Lucy briefly, and Lucy faints.
It's traumatic.
Yes. Yes. So when she comes to, it's the young George Emerson holding her, and who has also witnessed the same horrible murder, and you know there's a little bit of chaos in the streets, and they do have a moment,
mm-hmm.
and he, you know, makes sure that she's okay, and he says, "I'll walk you back to the pensione," and as they're walking, she says, "What happened to my pictures?" Because she had been out buying these pictures, and he goes back to get them, but as they're walking, he gets very upset.
They're covered in blood.
He doesn't tell her why, but he just tosses them into the Arno. Like, oh, you don't want those.
Right.
And so later on, you know, as they're walking and they're talking, he says, he's very upset and he was very moved. And he said, I couldn't, you know, I had to get rid of them. I couldn't let you even see them because they had blood on them. And, you know, Lucy's really struck by that because there's also very interesting this whole theme of male and female, women and men. It's an eye opener for her to see a man behave in that way, this way where she had never thought that men could get the heebie-jeebies, you know.
But she also thinks he's a bit of a boy, which he is. He's boyish.
Yes, and she's girlish. Right. Yeah. There's that one point where this is later on, where the narrator says, now, I'm sure that the reader has realized that Lucy is in love with George, but Lucy has not yet realized that she's in love with George. And so she doesn't. I mean, she's having these feelings, and they're confusing, they're complicated, and they're repressed. I mean, there's a whole lot of repression going on in this novel. But they do have this moment. So later on, the whole party goes out for a little trip outside of Florence by carriage.
Fiesole, right?
To Fiesole, yes. And driven by Italians. And during this time, Lucy, you know, once they kind of get to the countryside, and it's a beautiful spring day, and Lucy kind of wanders away from her female companion, Charlotte, and I think she's with Miss Lavish, and she stumbles into a grove of violets, this beautiful grove of violets, and kind of actually literally stumbles down a hill and straight into George's arms, and George kisses her. But this kiss is seen by Charlotte, and that's the end of Florence. The next day, Charlotte and Lucy leave. Charlotte has words with young George, and they leave.
And tells Lucy never to tell anyone that
never
that,
to tell
about
anyone
this insult.
Right, this insult that has happened to her that George has given her. So,
so fast forward. We don't have to do all the detail, right?
Right, but I think what's interesting is that's the part that's really told in detail, and then there's a lot of the novel that's told that's just told rather than shown. Yeah. I mean, that's the part that let's say that show don't tell. That's the part that's shown, and so retrospectively, we find out that. While in Rome, Lucy also met this man, Cecil, who is, how would you describe him? He is British, good family, well-connected.
Well, let's talk about what happens before we talk about what he's like. They wind up engaged. She winds up engaged
to
another.
So he proposes marriage to her twice in Rome. Mm-hmm. She refuses both times. And then back in England, they still meet and he proposes again and she accepts.
And this happens before we actually encounter Cecil.
That's
right?
True.
Yeah. So let's.
But then once we encounter Cecil.
let's just say to know him is not necessarily to love him.
Cecil really, you know, I was just saying in the gym, Cecil could, I feel like he would be at home in an Oscar Wilde comedy. That he is so over the top. He's priggish. He's a snob. But he's not a bad guy. I give this to Forrester, is that he's not setting up Cecil is the bad guy and George Emerson is the good guy. He's not. I mean, they're human.
You could picture him on the, almost on the spectrum.
Yeah. I mean, he
can't relate to, I mean, he insults virtually everyone that he comes in contact with.
I was suggesting that perhaps, Cecil's gay. I mean, E.M. Forrester famously was gay. And perhaps Cecil, because Cecil doesn't seem that interested in women.
He also doesn't seem interested in men either.
Is interested in Cecil.
He's interested in books. He's a bit pompous. You know, he has very definitive ideas.
But he says something interesting to Lucy about the room and the view.
Yeah.
Right? So... and I should have bookmarked this part where he says, I see you. Let me think. She's the room and he's the view. Do you remember this?
But I don't know that his, I mean, I guess I've been thinking about this whole, because the room and the view keeps coming back, right? They go back, they wind up going back to, you know, they meet because of this thing with having a room with a view. And I guess I think about a room as kind of an internal space, you know, it's an enclosed space, and the view is that broad vista on the world that opens out into it. And I think that the novel kind of has fun with that, the tension between those things, right? Because you need a place that you feel safe. You need people that you rely on in that room, but you also need someone who can pull you out fully into the world. And I think that's what the travelers, the tourists are working toward. They're simultaneously trying to encounter something new, but not something that's too new. So they want some of the comforts from home. And I think the challenge is realizing for Lucy is realizing that love is going to force her to grow herself. It's not simply going to be that you can simply travel somewhere or meet someone and be unchanged. Because if that's the case, it's not truly love if it doesn't challenge you in some way.
Well, and speaking of challenging, so, and we're talking about this grand tour. These three young people have separately, you know, Lucy, George Emerson, and Cecil have made this grand tour separately and have returned to England. And I'd say two out of the three have been changed. And that's Lucy and George. I don't think Cecil is changed by his travels. Why? I don't know.
Well, because he views Italy as an object to put into a box as a way his knowledge of Italy he uses as a weapon against other people. It's always that you're not doing Italy right kind of thing. Like he's kind of the worst. Right. He's kind of the negative image I would say of myself if someone asks me.
I was going to say, am I like that?
Right. Well, that's that thing. You're always like, am I exactly? Am I being a little bit too pedantic or too?
Our kids think I'm like Cecil when I take them.
You're not like Cecil.
Yeah, it's a.
So, I we don't. We, suffice it to say that love wins in the end. Love triumphs.
That room with a view. That she actually said. I mean, Cecil describes himself as a room, and. You know, you said about that Italy is something he can put in a box, but isn't also Lucy something he can put in a box?
Yes, absolutely.
That's what he's looking for. Lucy's going to be...
Well, everything in his world is something he can put in a box. Every person in his world is someone
he can put in a box. Right, that he can categorize and delineate and research and...
And that seems to be something very much on Forster's mind, it's something I think of... Very much as a reaction against Victorianism, right? As a kind of neo-romantic, open up to the world and open up to this world of emotion and the inner life that when we're sensitive to it calls us to greater depths of experience and greater depths of emotion.
Yeah,
and that's very much what Mr. Emerson is sort of preaching in his eccentric way.
So. I guess the novel is pretty much divided between what happens in Italy and what happens in England, yeah. Back in England.
Yeah.
And there's more, I think more of the novel actually takes place back in England. But it's what happens in Italy shapes everything that comes after.
Yeah, I really like the idea, though, that Italy becomes... There's a way of thinking about Italy in which, you know, it's something that you travel to, but any place you go, there's always the you that you're bringing to the place, right? And that's Italy, you know, the experience of Italy for Italians is you're never going to experience any place you go to the way a native is going to experience. And that's great because you have an entirely new set of a new person to pour into that place, a different person than those people. Mm. And that's great. That's why we go.
Right.
It's
right. Well, it's sort of like showing a guest or a visitor to your hometown or your area, your region, and you suddenly see things that you don't see every day.
Yep.
You know, they say, "Oh, wow, this is so cute, this street." And you're like, "This street? I go down the street every day." But I think this book, and actually also Where Angels Fear to Tread, this idea of foreignness, you know, the British as foreign and Italy as foreign are ideas that Forster keeps coming back to in this book. I'm both in poking fun at it, but also I think taking it very seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there's a tendency with both these novels for Forster to kind of portray Italians as, I mean, it's really stereotypical. They're, you know, they're murdering each other for an unpaid debt, or the carriage driver, you know, he gets his girlfriend to come along on the trip by saying, "Ah, she's my sister." And she sits up and they're making out in the front seat. And the British are super uptight, and the Italians are live and let live, and you know, like the very also the uptight Anglicans and the Catholics who are a little bit more all over the place. But I think Forster's also poking fun at those stereotypes, even while he's using them. I didn't realize actually in this version in the. I guess this is the Everyman Library, that it does have that. So in 1958, Forster wrote a very short, very depressing epilogue to A Room with a View that follows Lucy and George after their marriage. And I don't think...
I don't need to know what happens in World War I and World War II. Right? Really.
I don't really want to think about it. Right. The movie, well, and actually the book ends much more on a much lighter note with Lucy and George back in Florence on their honeymoon. And sure enough, they've got a room with the view there. You know, mm-hmm. I think that, yeah. I do think that idea of the room with the view is, as far as love, is a meeting of, perhaps it's a meeting of the mind and the heart. You know, the room being the mind, the heart being the view. And that maybe George and Lucy meet on that level.
Mm-hmm. Well, they elope, right? So at the end, they're willing to throw convention aside.
Yeah.
And meet purely on that level.
Yeah. So there's a room with a view.
So I'm trying to think of things, landmarks in this novel that I don't know if we've talked about. Like, have we talked about San Miniato al Monte?
I think we may have when we were talking about in the second Dante episode about places to go in Florence that not everyone goes to. So San Miniato al Monte is a church way up on the hill. You can walk up there. It's a nice, healthy walk. You can also take a bus to get closer to it. Beautiful church with a beautiful view. You know, I'm sure Forster's thinking of that because he has San Miniato is a key location. So is Fiesole, which also offers a beautiful view of
Florence. Also figures prominently in the story.
San Miniato is great. It's also another famous cemetery up there. It's right. More where Santa Croce has a lot of the literary figures, and San Miniato has more of the political figures buried up there.
So this is my first time through the novel. I loved it. I thought it was, much more of a fun read than I thought it would be.
It's funny.
Yeah, and it's very funny.
He's a funny writer. All right, but.
But I was going to ask you, after not having read it for 20 years and coming back to it, what's.
Well, I actually read it 2 or 3 years ago. I read it towards the beginning of the pandemic. I remember. And also then read Howard's End. And I would say, you know, I haven't read Passage to India, but Howard's End is a masterwork. Room with the View, I love. I mean, I love, as I said, this narrative voice. I love the way he crafts his novels. I think he's really...
Yes.
He deserved a Nobel Prize. I mean, I think
he was nominated 20 times.
He deserved it. But, and maybe that's why he's just like, I'm not writing novels anymore, you know? But, Howard's End is a very rich, it's a longer novel. It's a more developed novel. I think every time I read this novel, I see something new and I think it's interesting. And as I said, it's fresh and it's interesting and it makes me want to go to Italy and see it new. Even Florence, you know, a city that I've actually lived in, that I see it a little bit differently when I read this book.
Yep. That's nice.
You know, that said, I would, you know, he's talking about a Florence of 100 years ago. And what's interesting is he's really describing, we're talking about the Grand Tour. He's really describing the very tail end of the Grand Tour. This is like the last, the death rattle of the Grand Tour. Right. But you might argue that
the Grand Tour lives still, on.
It lives on in these kinds of, you know, tour packages or college kids going on a Eurail trip.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, you know, sometimes you say, well, you know, if it's Tuesday, it must be Belgium. This idea that, you know, these kind of trips where you're really just kind of doing a cursory, quick blow by, you know. In A Room with a View, they're actually staying in Florence for a month. And then they move on to Rome, and I think they stay another month. This is like a whole year that Lucy and Charlotte are, or maybe not a year, but 6 months that Lucy and Charlotte are traveling. So it's a significant amount of time. It's obviously a lot of money. And I think that in these, you know, we have more limited time because of our insane approaches to work, our work-life imbalance, that we don't feel like we can take more than a week at a time. So people try, you know, it's not unusual for me to hear people saying, oh, I'm going to go to Italy and I have 10 days and I want to go to Venice, Florence, Rome, and also see the Amalfi Coast and the Cinque Terre. Like, you're really going to spend most of your time on the train. But there's something to be said for doing that sort of drive-by view, because there may be things that when you get home, you say, I really wish we had spent more time in Florence, or right, more time in, I don't know, you know, Sorrento or Positano, or actually Rome. I would like to go back and only stay in Rome.
Right. But yeah.
Yeah. So I think that it's an interesting, this idea though, for the Grand Tour at this time, I don't think they're expecting to go back. They do go back on right, their honeymoon.
Right.
And it's a happy ending. It's a fun book. I have been very much encouraging our kids to read it.
Sam read it.
Did Sam he?
Read it, yeah.
No, he didn't.
He's got our copy of it. Yeah, he did.
Well, he's got our copy of it. I don't think
he's
ready.
Yeah, we've got these library books out. Yeah. All right. So thanks. Thanks everyone
for
joining.
And Room with the View. You know, so read Room with the View. Then you can go to Florence. And then you can go to Piazza Signoria, San Miniato, Fiesole. I mean, there's a whole bunch of places.
And we'll see you there.
And we won't be stabbing anyone and getting blood on your souvenirs.
Vendetta! All right.
I hope. All right, enjoy the violets.
Alla prossima.
Ciao, ciao.